I was born and raised practicing Buddhism. So this question came after the talk yesterday, and it's connected to a question about delusion. I was born and raised practicing Buddhism. Does this mean that Buddhist principles are my beliefs based on my conditioning? In other words, am I deluded in thinking that Buddhist teachings represent universal truth? So what I would say is that what delusion is not being aware that beliefs are beliefs. Beliefs are not in and of themselves problematic. They become problematic when we don't know that they're beliefs and we just simply take them as truth. So the Buddha often pointed to this in conversation with people, you know, when you say, this alone is true, everything else is wrong. There's a clinging to that belief. And so too, it's a clinging to the belief that can be problematic. That clinging can create kind of views or opinions or beliefs that other people are stupid or, you know, they don't know what's right, or, you know, so that creates views and kind of judgments around things, as opposed to just, oh, this is the belief. And then the Buddha also points to looking at, so again, noticing that they are beliefs. What are skillful beliefs? What are beliefs that support us to move in the direction of freedom? So we could say that, you know, the Buddhist beliefs, which we have to start with this, you know, we hear the teachings, we have to start from somewhere. We bring these beliefs into our system. You know, there has to be some kind of a belief that it's useful to observe my experience and kind of be curious about, is it permanent or impermanent? How about that reliability? Is it reliable? You know, so there has to be some kind of view that kind of inclines us to act in that direction. So those are at first, in fact, the first aspect of the Eightfold Path is right view. And at first, right view is a view, you know, it's a belief. And then that kind of shapes how we respond. What seems to happen, you know, Tam talked about these levels of wisdom the other day, you know, that first we have to hear something, then we kind of think about it, you know, kind of reflect on it. Does this make sense? Maybe begin to engage. And then the third level of wisdom is where the mind begins to understand experience more directly. And so there's one scholar said that the right view, or the understanding that results from holding right view, from holding it as a belief, but we know that it's a belief, okay? So it's not just held to as this alone is true, you know, it's like, okay, this is the belief. This is a belief that seems to be helpful in shaping my, movement towards ease and peace. This seems useful. So we kind of look at our beliefs, know their beliefs, and then look at them and say, okay, this one seems useful. This one not so useful. Okay, let me look at that one that's not so useful. And so when we find a useful belief, like wise view that the Buddha taught, and observe our experience from that perspective, what happens is there's a kind of a deepening of the experiential understanding that's connected with that view. And one scholar said of wise view that the insight or the understanding that comes through the practice, this bhavanamaya panya, the wisdom of insight, he said it's not a view that's like right or wrong, this like true or false. He called it a different way of seeing. And so it's not held as a belief in the same way. It's more of the understanding that comes through experience. And then it's no longer held as a view. It's more of an understanding that's lived. It's a lived understanding. So that's my thought about that, Pam. How would you like to add something or no?
No, I'm noticing that there are some other questions. So
okay. Why don't you pull them up and why don't you read them and why don't you start with that?
So this actually is, I think, dovetails on what you were just saying, Andrea. The question is, I love your guidance to ask the body how to relax, but can wanting to relax be an agenda too? So I think based on what Andrea was just saying, it's we're not trying to get rid of our agendas. So we don't have an agenda to be agendaless. We have a practice, and the practice is a practice of insight, which is that we see our agendas for what they are. So just as what I heard Andrea just saying is that we may notice that some of our perspectives, our views, our orientation, our agendas are wholesome, supportive, helpful. Helpful in this case doesn't mean good or bad, right or wrong. We're not talking about it in that way. We're talking about, from a Buddhist context, useful, helpful, supportive is always about, again, Andrea's been talking about, does it lead toward more suffering, or does it lead toward a sense of freedom, of liberation? And that, as she was just describing, it's not an idea. It's we have to be in our experience to know whether or not that's true. So as we become familiar with the teachings and with our own experience, we may notice that there are certain kinds of guidance or orientation, or in this case, an agenda, like, oh, I've noticed that it's really more helpful for my body to be relaxed, for example. Or I may notice that habitually, you know, in the spirit of the hindrances, my body is not relaxed. And the absence of tension is a state that feels more in the spirit of the seven factors. There's a kind of ease, there may be joy, there may be things like that. So the instructions that we're offering, yeah, those are agendas, you might say. But they're not agendas in the way that we're saying this is good and something else is bad. They're agendas more in the spirit of what Andrea was just describing as they're pointing us in a direction that offers, I love the way you said it, a different way of seeing. So most of us are habitually oriented in one direction or another, and the instructions that we're offering are helping unstick us from our habits and to begin to pay attention so that we can see more, we can see beyond our habitual agenda-ridden way of engaging with our life. And again, we call that, it's a slice of freedom when that happens.
Do you want to take the next one too?
Sure. So yesterday, Pam mentioned that us wanting to be mindful and then being pulled away is evidence of non-self. So if it's non-self, then who or what is it that pulls us away? I think you're answering your own question. So I think what I was saying in essence is that, you know, some sense of I, me, and mine that thinks she's in control is saying, I want to be mindful. I think this was actually Andrea who said this yesterday. And then we sit down and we notice, you know, the mind is doing whatever the mind does, right? I'm not in charge. I'm not in control. That actually my experience, what I call my experience, is conditioned by all kinds of things that are not I, me, and mine. And so what pulls us away is not an I. What pulls us away is not a me doing it. It is, there's observation of attending to experience and not attending to experience. And we have an influence on that. There's an in, we can influence. That's what like giving instruction is about. But we're not in charge. We don't get to control it. So really, I would say in response to the question, the invitation is to see, is to follow that question without the assumption of that there is a who or a what that's pulling us away, but to really see what is it? What is it? How is it that I'm there with my experience and then whoosh, I'm gone? How does that happen? And again, that we don't necessarily try to think it out, but the degree, when I talked about those three levels of wisdom, the degree to which we can be so fully present that we're seeing it happen as it happens, that's where really deep insight comes. And the suggestion is that if we pay attention there, we will notice that I'm not doing it, that there isn't a who that's pulling me away, that there is, that life itself is this dynamic, fluid unfolding. And this sense of me is, you know, added in. It's extra. It's normal. It's fine. We don't have to get rid of it. What we need to do is pay close enough attention to what's happening that we see for ourselves that it's just an idea. It's not actually baked into the immediacy of our experience, rather than saying, oh, I shouldn't see a self, or trying to convince myself cognitively there is no self. That's just more ideas, views, agendas, rather than the immediacy. This, again, this phrase I like a lot, a different way of seeing. It looks like there is one more, Andrea, you want to take
bit.
Yeah.
Just to follow on, you made me think of something to share as a kind of an exploration around how to see, you know, how to be curious about that being pulled away. And there's a kind of a simple tool or practice that I like to offer sometimes in the walking, particularly. I offered the seeing, hearing, moving, touching practice at the beginning. But in the field, when you're kind of aware while walking of seeing happening, let yourself be curious when you're in that place of when there's kind of a broad sense of seeing, and when the mind looks at something. So noticing the shift between seeing and looking. And what makes that happen? Usually it's, if you're curious about that, you'll see it's not an I or me that does that. It happens. We orient. Often because of some, you know, the nature of the processes of our body and mind, you know, our system is designed to orient towards change, essentially. So if there's movement that happens, you know, if you're taking a walk and a bird flies across your path, you're going to be looking at that bird. And it's not an I or me doing that. It's the processes unfolding. So noticing that shift, notice the shift of attention from seeing to looking. And then maybe from one looking to another looking, that shift of attention. We can do this with hearing as well, you know, kind of taking in the ambient sound of like what's going on. And then suddenly there's a motorcycle that goes by and phew, you're listening to that motorcycle. So noticing that shift of attention. When the attention shifts from one thing to the next, often we don't notice that. It happens quickly and we're habituated to start thinking about what the attention has shifted to. There's a very strong habit to start thinking about what the attention has shifted to. But if we kind of get curious about that shift, that attentional shift, we'll get familiar with that. And then we'll actually begin to open to just this place of seeing what is it that pulls us away. One of the biggest causes of being pulled away is that our attention shifts and we didn't notice it. So that I offer that as a little practice tool. You know, it's fun. It's really fun to play with that, especially in the walking time frame. So this last question, why don't we save that for this afternoon?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.